Evidence Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this October the 8th on the West Coast, now October the 9th on the East Coast, and in the Central Time Zone. I'd like to welcome those listening in around the world on Wind Talkers Radio Network as well, and I know many of you find tonight's guest very interesting. Why? Because he's a scientist extraordinaire and an inventor extraordinaire, author, lecturer, teacher, a resident science advisor, and also my good friend, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show tonight.
Hey, Don. Thank you. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. We've been discussing this rash of UFO sightings all week. On the show, you and I did a show last week, and we determined that we had much more to say, and I know you did some research, I did some research, and I'm coming to some conclusions about our friend Otis Carr. Not that I want to cast any dispersions, but the story just doesn't add up, and discernment does. Let me say that. And I know you have quite a bit that you want to say, so.
Well, it doesn't matter because my relationship with Carr was very specifically directed towards learning some facts and trying to ascertain whether or not he did actually have a relationship with our friend Nikola Tesla. Mm-hmm. You know, if he was a scoundrel like so many others, that's just the way the ball bounces. I didn't have anything to do with it, but it's just interesting that after so many years, and even after the fact that he is no longer with us, that more stuff is showing up. You know what I mean? It's pretty interesting, actually. Have you actually found additional information since we addressed this on your show last week?
Yes, well, I found some things, and of course there is the usual stuff that you can't find. Now, let's use a little bit of logic, and for those that are just joining us and hadn't heard last week's discussion or any of the other discussions that we've had about this gentleman, he was alleged to have befriended Nikola Tesla. And we know how that can come about because I spoke about how George H. Scherf Sr. befriended Tesla. He despised his son, who I have identified as George H. W. Bush later on in history. So the individual that we are talking about was an acquaintance of George H. Scherf Sr., the accountant, a.k.a. business manager, a.k.a. advisor, assistant, whatever name you want to give him. He was a spy. Scherf was a spy. And what kind of person would a spy bring to a scientist of the stature, an inventor of the stature of Nikola Tesla? One would presume likely another spy. Now, in looking up let me add this for the listeners, that Carr was alleged to have created several models of what he called the OTCX, and he had Model 1 and Model 2 that were allegedly planes that could, or not planes, but saucers that could fly to the moon, go out into space, in other words. And I'll tell you, from close examination of the craft themselves, the photographs with the rivets he has on this thing, it's impossible. it's impossible that that craft would have been able to travel in space. And anyone that works in the aerospace industry would agree. Now, that in and of itself debunks many of the other stories that came out about Carr, whether or not he was a threat to the government or his program had to be quashed, who allegedly flew with him on this craft that I'm telling you would most likely was not able to fly. I see why he got a patent on an amusement park ride. But there were many other anomalies, Jim, that I want to discuss regarding his alleged family, his alleged birthplace, his alleged death, the date of death, the place of his death, all of those things. I want to talk about those because those are big clues. Those are morsels of what I call evident footprints. And they don't add up in his story nor in his alleged scientific acumen. They do not. I think they
well,
may.
Well, I can certainly interject some things about his scientific acumen.
Yes.
When
please,
I met him,
please do,
and talked to him personally, I mean, there were just things that he said and described which nobody with a real scientific or engineering background would say. But I have to tell you, though, that didn't bother me so much at the time because I wasn't expecting to be talking to a physicist or a scientist so much as a person who may have usurped or otherwise obtained some information that he didn't necessarily understand and was trying to run with it. And that's kind of the way I looked at it. The interesting thing, though, was that he did say certain things to me in the short time that I was with him. Well, it wasn't that short. Actually, we stayed with him for about 12 hours. And in that time period, we covered a lot of territory as far as his life is concerned and his relationship with Tesla and also the technologies that he was supposedly working on. But it was the technological descriptions and things of that nature that concerned me the most. And frankly, I got the least satisfaction when we were talking about those very subjects. The thing that I remember very clearly was I asked him, I said, without necessarily giving away anything of a proprietary nature or a critical nature, I said, can you at least give me an idea of how this concept of anti-gravity works and how you were able to figure it out? And he said, okay, I can do that. And he then immediately said, consider this concept. What would you have if you cut a motor in half? And I just looked at him. I mean, first of all, I wasn't expecting, you know, to be tested in that way. And secondly, I mean, there's a large number of potential answers to that question.
An oil spill, for example.
And I was just in the kind of mood, especially in my youth, where I just blurted out, well, you'd have half a motor. And he really looked at me with daggers in his eyes. And I could tell from the response I got that he was serious. Whatever he was going to tell me about, he was serious. And he resented the fact that I made light of it. So I said to him, okay, Otis, look, here's what I mean. I said there are synchronous motors, you know, three-phase motors, single-phase motors, you know, squirrel cage motors, DC motors. You know, what kind of motor are we cutting in half? And which way are we cutting it in half? Are we cutting it parallel to the axis? Or are we cutting it perpendicular to the axis of rotation, you know, I said, at least give me some clues. And he thought about that for a minute, and then he said, you're right. He said, we'd be cutting it perpendicular to the axis of rotation. And he said, it would probably have to be a squirrel cage motor or a three-phase motor of some sort. And I said, okay. I said, under those conditions, I said, for one thing, the motor would definitely not turn anymore. And I was about to say something else, and he goes, that's right. And he said, and that's what you should be thinking about if you really want to understand what's going on here. And then he went off on another tangent, and he never really got back to that. But the interesting thing about that is that answer stuck in my craw. And many years later, when I was working with other devices and doing something completely different from the whole car scene, it suddenly occurred to me, you know, the guy was, I don't know if he was senile or not, but he definitely was suffering from the effects of alcoholism because his stomach was hugely distended. His nose was much more prominent than W.C. Fields, and his face was just adorned with pockmarks and broken blood vessels, and you don't get that by sipping ginger ale. So it's very possible that his mind wasn't as clear, you know, as it used to be. And it occurred to me, maybe he didn't really mean a motor. Maybe he meant a transformer. And the interesting thing about that is, if you have a transformer that's wound, not concentrically wound, but wound with separate coils on each side, and if you were to cut that in half while it was operational and fully loaded, the two halves would fly apart from each other. And, of course, apparently that's due to a magnetic force. But that was the only worthwhile hint that he ever gave me, you know, in any direction concerning the actual technology. And, frankly, I didn't get very far with it. But as a result of my interaction with Carr, I was able to put the relationship I had at that point in time with a third individual in this story by the name of Warren Goetz into perspective. And I think that was much more valuable information than I got from Carr concerning anything technological. And my association with Goetz in later years produced a lot more information about what an anti-gravity type device might be and how it would actually work.
Okay,
and I found that to be very interesting considering the fact that he actually had Carr's Blue Notebook.
Yes, now before we go into that any further, can we backtrack a little bit and can I lay out some discrepancies in the Otis Carr story?
Yeah, by all means, go ahead.
Okay, and then I do want to come back to the Warren Goetz issue because it directly relates to what you're talking about. I mean, you brought it up. Of course it relates to what you're talking about. But you understand what I mean in the sense of who Otis Carr is and how much credit was given to him for having developed the craft. The story, which has been written about in several books, the O'Neill book, John O'Neill's book, where he spent a lot of time interviewing Tesla and interviewed George H. Scherf Sr. And related the story of this young man that Scherf hired to bring birdseed to the pigeons. Now, some say those were doves. They weren't really pigeons that Tesla had for pets, but he seemed to attract all the birds if he would sit in the park. They came to his hotel window, and he would put bird seed out the window, and they would bring these bags of bird seed every week or two up to him, and it's alleged that Carr sat there and spent time talking to him. Now, this is somebody whose job is to fetch this, and he's allegedly working for the hotel. He's alternatively described as having worked in the hotel industry at the desk for some 30 years, specifically in New York and in Baltimore, but you don't hear much about the New York side of it. In O'Neill's book, he talks about him being pretty much a gopher, for lack of a better word, an errand boy for George Scherf. And maybe Scherf just didn't feel like carrying a big bag of birdseed up to Tesla's hotel room. I was doing some research on Scherf, and I came across a patent, and I brought this up on other shows. It was a device called an illumination controller, and it was a very sophisticated kind of projector. If you remember the movie projectors they used to show movies to the school kids, the teacher was always dumbfounded about how to insert the film into the capstan and the pinch roller of the machine to get it to go over the lens properly, to get it to run. They always had problems with those machines. And it looked very much like a projector, and it had another attachment on it that adjusted the lighting. It was difficult to tell from the drawings of this patent, which was, by the way, not in Tesla's name, but George H. Scherf. Scherf was actually representing himself as the inventor of this this device, the illumination controller. And it was very sophisticated, and the drawings were very misleading and very primitive and incomplete, I would say, from what I had seen. I looked at the whole patent. What really caught my attention was the fact that this was witnessed by Hermann Frosch. Hermann Frosch was a German chemist who worked for Standard Oil Company, and he was made the president of Frank Rockefeller's company, Union Sulphur. In part, well, they were using sulphur probably for explosives, you know, for military weapons. And Frosch also patented some extraction methods by forcing pressurized water into oil wells to get the oil to come up. These were some patents that he had. And I found it extremely interesting that now I had a letter from Colorado Springs from Nikola Tesla to George H. Scherf asking about the status of certain of his inventions, the litigation, the patent hearings, and then I had a second reference to Scherf working at the Union Sulphur Company or being associated with the Union Sulphur Company and its president, Hermann Frosch. Why would such an important man witness his invention, of which he had no, absolutely no technical knowledge or no ability? He was a spy. We proved that where he was from, Durlitz, Germany. And he was associated with Union Sulphur Company and Union Bank and the Arnold Constable department store, and worked there at the time when the Union Banking Corporation was shut down. He had to have an income of some sort. And it turns out Arnold Constable was the depot, the arrival point for many of the spies that they brought in from Germany. They were sneaking them in through that company. So we have all of these circumstances that show George Scherf was not really working for for Nikola Tesla. He was working for the Illuminati bankers and their corporations, and part of this overseas funneling of funds to fund the Nazi war effort. Now, Carr comes in probably because by that point, Tesla had it with Scherf. You don't really hear anything about this, but the last couple of years of his life, Tesla really didn't concern himself with Scherf at all. And there's another individual through the Arnold Constable store who was introduced to Tesla and spent a couple of hours talking to him on a bench out in Long Island. They arranged for this meeting. Scherf arranged that meeting. And Otis Carr is not mentioned at all during this time period. He was mentioned in 1914. Now, he would have been 10 years old at that time. They allege he was born in 1904. So in 1914, when he was allegedly doing these drawings for George H. Scherf, he would have been too young. He would not have been at the Brooklyn School of Art. And there's another story that says that in 1923, he was at the Ohio School for Business Art in Cleveland, Ohio. Here's a man who was allegedly born on December 7th, 1904, going to school in Cleveland in 1923, or they say about 1923. And when he dies in 1982, all they can say is he died in September. They don't have his birth date. I mean, his death date. But in 1904, they had his birth date. That's a typical anomaly that appears in all of these infiltrators in our country. And I've proven this time and again with presidents and senators and congressmen and other infiltrators, that their birth dates don't add up and their death dates don't add up. Now, let's say he went to the Cleveland School of Art, okay, the Ohio School for Business Art. Why would he then go to the Brooklyn School of Art? And he would have done that in 1914 at age 10. That's unlikely. So somewhere along the line, that story has been fudged. We have two accounts of a guy being trained at two different art schools. Let me tell you, the artwork that I saw that he did was horrible. It was childish. And these were the patent documents. So they took Tesla's drawings and they recreated them is what they did. No doubt about that. Then all of a sudden, the guy's in hotel management and he's in Baltimore. Why would he go to Baltimore, of all places? I mean, he was in New York City. Why would he have left to do this work in Baltimore? And then Oklahoma City. Well, Baltimore puts him in the proximity of Washington, number one. Oklahoma City would have put him in the proximity of Tinker Air Force Base, and that plays into much of my research and much of what was going on internationally. And then I found a third description of him dying in Gardnersville, Nevada in 2005. Wait a minute. Now, this is the guy that supposedly died in 1982. Someone else is naming a town in Nevada and saying he died there in 2005. And I would submit that he was probably working for Navy at that time, and he died in 2005. I discern that, but in San Diego, California. The rest of the stories are just that, just stories. Now, he was alleged to have removed some things from Tesla's suite. Tesla had a laboratory there, and you had even spoken about the amount of detail that he had given. It's quite possible that they blamed him for taking the notebook, and maybe he had it. Some people had it. Maybe they took it away from him and gave it to Goetz. Maybe Getz lifted it.
Getz definitely lifted it, because I can tell you how that happened. The first part of the story I got actually from Otis Carr, because when I met him, the only introductory card I had, so to speak, was the name of Gene Carini. And he warmed up to that pretty well. Asked me how long I had worked with Carini and this type of thing. And he tested me a little bit and said, well, what kind of projects was Gene involved with when you were with him, you know, and all this. And I told him it was primarily the Energized Flywheel. I said, but he also told me, he being Carini, about Carr's previous inventions like the OTCX1 and the Hummingbird. And when I talked to him about the Hummingbird, he was considerably excited. Now, the Hummingbird was supposedly a home power generation unit which worked on a mysterious electromechanical process. And that's the device which I actually traced back more directly than Carini's interpretation to Otis, Tesla himself. But the way the thing actually evolved was, I asked him, I had seen materials in Getz's possession after I moved up to Michigan that I was curious about. And I mentioned to Otis Carr, do you know anything about a Utron model and a vortex motor? You know, and I described them to him. And he got really, I don't know what the emotion would be, agitated, I guess. And he said, where did you hear about those things? And I said, well, I didn't hear about them. I've seen them. I said, they're in the possession of a guy named Warren Getz. And he said, Warren Getz, he said, that SOB, he said, I always thought it was him. And I said, what do you mean you always thought it was him? And he said, well, he said, when Carini left me after the accident in Oklahoma City, and he would not, you know, continue on with me after that to California, he said, when I got out to the West Coast, I put an ad in the paper for an electronics man to help me with building electronic devices in a research environment. And he said, I got quite a few applicants, he said, but the interesting thing was the guy who I thought was the best qualified was a recently retired officer, and I don't remember what his rank was. I think he was captain or something, by the name of Warren Getz, who had been in the military and worked with radar and other sophisticated equipment, and he was the guy that I favored to hire. He said, he came in, I interviewed him, I liked him, and it looked like it was a good match. I told him I'd get back to him. He said, in the meantime, I contacted the Army and inquired about Getz, and they said that he had been released from active duty on a Section 8, which I've since come to understand means he was a little bit Looney Tunes. So the next day, when Getz returned back for his second interview, that's when Otis Carr informed him that he would not be hired. And he said, and Otis told me, he said, that very night, my lab was broken into, and three pieces of equipment and one very special log book, he called it, were stolen. And he said the equipment was a Utron that was partially complete, a Vortex motor, and a 14-inch model of the OTC X3, which was never built, and my blue notebook, or the blue notebook. And so the interesting thing is, when I met Goetz, he openly displayed the Vortex motor, which was in operational condition, the Utron, which was very, very strange to examine because the outer portion of it was very, very professionally machined. It was perfect. And you could unscrew it at the equator, and there were absolutely perfect fine threads. I don't know what pitch they were, but anyway, it went together seamlessly. And yet on the inside was, there were parts installed which looked like they were made by an amateur, who knew nothing whatsoever about machining or winding coils or anything. And they were of such completely different, character that was one of the things that really struck me about it. It looked like they were made by two different people, and apparently they were. But anyway, that was the story that Goetz, that Carr gave me about Goetz. And Goetz kind of drove some nails into his own coffin, because one of the things that he told, and not only to me, but to many people, was that he actually had a 14-inch model of a saucer, which was complete, along with a remote control pack, and he claimed that he got it running and was flying it around on the shore of Lake Huron, and he let it go too long in one direction, and it actually got out of range of his remote control, and he doesn't know where it went. He couldn't call it back. So I never saw that, of course, but that was the story. And then along with those objects, there was an enormous amount of material associated with OTC Enterprises. So I really believe that regardless of where the Blue Notebook had its origins, they definitely wound up in the hands of Warren Goetz via Otis Carr.
Now, you correct me if I'm wrong. You did say that Goetz, you thought, had previously been with the Navy. Is that correct?
No, it was the Army.
Oh, the Army. Okay. Wow.
Yeah, he was in the Army, and I've seen pictures of him in uniform, but it was stated that it was the Army by Otis Carr himself, and he was, it had something to do with testing radar equipment.
Okay. Yeah. There are some other accounts, and of course, the Cincinnati Skeptics published an article in their volume 12, number 5. From April, May of 2003. And they say that Carr claimed his association with Tesla began about 1925 when a hotel visitor asked him to fetch a bag of unsalted peanuts for feeding pigeons. And this is where Carr talks about free energy with Tesla. Hardly qualified, I think, to talk about that at that point. At that precise moment, he went and did a number of interviews on the Long John Nebel show out of New York on WOR.
Mm-hmm. And that was the name of the guy I couldn't think of last week. It was Long John Nebel.
Yeah, I did my research, you see. So, but the Utron, as far as I know, was a Tesla invention. And that existed in the hands of the military, particularly the Navy, in 1943 during the first Philadelphia experiment. Two of three.
Well, those Utrons would have been much, much bigger. This thing was about the size of an orange. And it had its origins, I think, somewhere else. I don't think this was the thing that was involved with the Philadelphia experiment. But it was nonetheless a beautifully machined instrument. And it even had an 80-pound version. 80 what?
80 pounds they weighed.
Yeah, well, this was very small. This didn't weigh any 80 pounds. Yes. But it was made of aluminum, and it was a very hard alloy of aluminum, probably like 60-61 titanium aluminum or something of that sort. It was very beautifully machined. It kept a good finish. And the very, very tip of the cone was a small steel insert, also a cone, which matched perfectly the taper of the cone in that it was almost perfectly machined with the same exact contour. And I asked Goetz about that at one point, and he said, yes, he said, that was made to spin in an agate or sapphire bearing. And that's the reason why the stainless steel tip is positioned at one end of the thing. The other end had a hollow copper shaft coming out of it. And that terminated in a bearing support of some sort, which made the impression that this thing had been removed from another device and all of it was not present. But the thing that was interesting was that this copper tube, which was threaded into the end of the Utron, was hollow. And the reason I find that really interesting was because on Goetz's ship, which was 32 feet in diameter, and that was a heck of a lot larger than the ship that Carr tried to energize in Oklahoma City, which I think was like 12 or 15 feet in diameter. This huge craft, the one that I worked on, it had a magnetic pole that came down through the center of the ship, acted as a support for the cab or the passenger section, acted as a center of rotation for both the upper and lower flanges of the ship, passed through a very sophisticated transmission, and terminated in two lag magnets, which were part of the undercarriage assembly, and projected down into the bottom flange, along with all the electrostatic equipment. And the interesting thing is that central shaft was also hollow. And according to Goetz, it was very important that be hollow, because it tied right into the functioning of the entire device. And I just found it all very interesting and very mysterious how all these pieces seemed to fit together in some way, but everybody that was involved with it was lying about everything, and that was very obvious after a while.
Now, you mentioned Gene Carini, and I think you mentioned him in conjunction with this Apple Valley episode that occurred where they supposedly had a craft that flew and then it was taken away by the government. There in this article from the Skeptics magazine, they reference Eugene Carini, who contributed $10,000 in order to obtain distributor rights for New England. This man still believes that Carr's ideas had validity. End of quote. Well, now, does that sound like the Gene Carini you knew?
Oh, yeah. There's only one Gene Carini, but he did not go with Carr to Apple Valley. He left Carr's service after the destruction of the ship in Oklahoma City and returned, you know, to Connecticut, where he hailed from.
Okay.
And that's where I met him. I met him in Connecticut.
Okay. There is no mention of Oklahoma City whatsoever in this article.
There's plenty of other articles that do mention the experience in Oklahoma City, and they also mention the fact that Long John Neville came all the way out from New York to be to witness the test in Oklahoma City, and was prepared to film the thing and eventually put it on TV. And I have lots of photographs of Carr lecturing directly to Long John Neville. I have photographs of the ship being assembled in Oklahoma City. It was actually done in a private airport in a hangar that was rented for the occasion. And I forget the name of the field, but I have since learned that it's no longer in existence. There was something built right over the top of it. I forget if it was a mall or a hotel or something. But anyway, in those days, it was on the outskirts of town, and it was in a pretty remote area. But so it was isolated and reasonably safe. But that's where the test supposedly occurred. And I heard most of the details about what happened, you know, at the actual test site from Carini, because Carini helped him build the darn thing. And on the day that the thing failed, there were several people that were long-time Getz supporters present. One of them was Norman Colton. Then, of course, there was Gene Carini. Another guy whose name I can't think of right at the moment, Kendrick or something like that. Kendricks. And then there was a woman that had a really bizarre name of Hildegar somebody. And after the problem occurred with the ship and one of the Utrons exploded and released mercury vapor all over the place, Carr supposedly rushed in there, hero style, to pull the plug or to shut it down or whatever. And he supposedly was enveloped in a big cloud of this mercury gas and wound up hospitalized with mercury poisoning. And I got pictures of all of that and even have the, you know, the explanations and the subtitles under the pictures. So, you know, if you want to dig into that, I could probably, well, I gave you the name of one guy's article, but there were several other ones that talked about the things that happened in the Oklahoma City demo, which was anything but a demonstration. I mean, it was a failure. And maybe you could track down more detail about that. But I did try for years, and I found that most of them were dead ends. Now, interestingly enough, I did locate a guy, and it was very, it was like a serendipitous experience. I was in Michigan at the time, and the guy that I met was a janitor, and he had been involved with the aircraft company that built parts of the saucer, the OTC X2, I guess it was, or the X, yeah, it must have been the X2. He said he remembered the whole thing very clearly. He was there when the test was attempted. And what he did for me at the time, which was not very much, but he told me the name of the newspaper that had been present at the time of the test and the gathering and all that kind of stuff with all these people. There were hundreds of people there. And I called the newspaper and got a hold of somebody in the morgue, and they sent me a bunch of articles, and they were somewhat disappointing, I might add. I mean, they didn't go into a lot of detail. But they at least proved that there was definitely a ship present here, and there was an attempt at a demonstration which didn't end well. And so I know from several different directions that there was a craft assembled here in Oklahoma City, and there was an attempt to fly it. Now, what happened when he relocated to Apple Valley? The only thing I have information about from three sources is the interaction between Otis Carr and Warren Goetz. And the three sources, of course, is Gene Carini, Otis Carr himself, and Goetz himself. So that's really as deep as I could dig into it at the time. And I was much more interested in the technological information than I was in the historical development of the whole thing, with the exception of any links that might have led back to Nikola Tesla.
Interesting. Now, in doing some research on Carr a little bit further, I find that the Social Security Administration says that his Social Security number was issued in the state of Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
When would that have occurred? Well, it could have occurred when he was at the, and I may have mispronounced the name, it's the Ohio Commercial School of Art in Cleveland. At least that's the claim. When you run all the cars from 1904 through the SSI database, he doesn't come up in the general listings. But he, even putting his name in there without the Social Security number, draws a blank.
Well, I don't know what that means, because the way I found Carr was actually through the Social Security Service. And they gave me, I fabricated a story when I was in Florida with Carini.
No. you did?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I was determined to find this guy, and I called and said that I was a police chief, and we had apprehended some kids that were trying to cash a Social Security check. And the lady was very kind. She said, I can tell you if that's for real or not. And she went and looked it up, and all I did was give them the name. Thank God they didn't ask me for any Social Security number. I didn't have one. But anyway, they came back and said, yeah, there is such an individual. And I said, well, it's really important that we find out if this check was actually used to pay these kids or if they stole it. And so she gave me his phone number, and that's how I met him.
Well, now, there are a number of Carrs alleged to either have been born in or have their Social Security numbers either issued in West Virginia or North Carolina. How does one mix that up? You know,
I have no idea.
Yeah, we're dealing with obfuscation here, big time. But nevertheless, did Carr ever mention anything about his family, the size of his family, or where he was born?
Yeah, he told me Elkins, West Virginia, which was no different from what I already knew from Dominic Lucchesi. And, by the way, I remembered his wife's name was Eleanor.
Okay.
But and I think he said something about having a daughter, but other than that, I don't think he ever mentioned any family.
Anything about his, or nothing about his birth family, huh?
Not to me. Now, he may have entrusted some information of that character to Gene, but I never had any reason to question Gene about it, so I really don't know.
Yeah, allegedly he had he came from a family with 13 children. That's a rather large family, and he seems not to have had any parents. So,
well, that's kind of strange if you have 13 kids and there's no parents.
Yeah. There's an Eleanor Carr who died in Brooklyn in 1994. I wonder if that's not the one that we're looking for.
That I don't know. The only time that I met Mrs. Carr was at that old age home on Bracey Drive. That was the name of the street, Bracey Drive, in some little outskirts town of Pittsburgh. And the reason I chuckled when I remembered it was because she never said a word, literally. I mean, she shuffled around there. She served sandwiches and coffee and stuff to me and Kenny Olmsted, who was with me at the time. And she came in the first time, and we were talking about something to do with the hummingbird. And Carr clammed up just like, you know, somebody that had a guilt complex or something. And he watched her, but he never said a word. And she walked around the table where we were sitting and laid out some placemats. And we perceived from that since we'd been talking for several hours, that they were going to serve some kind of a little meal. And then she went back out to the kitchen. And after she was gone, Carr just looked at me and said, "That's the wife." That was it. We were never introduced.
Well, here's an interesting anomaly. Again, I have a death date, February 1994. I guess in 1994 they didn't keep good records. Pittsburgh, Allegheny is the last residence. And her social security number was issued in Maryland. Might that have been in Baltimore?
Well, now that's possible. At least that ties in with the Baltimore thing.
Yeah, I think that's the one. But then again, we have obfuscation here, okay? Even by social security, we know what a great job they do, especially with our money. Well, the main reason in trying to do the genealogy, it's virtually impossible. That what you just told me led me to that information. I was primed and ready to look for it. But to have 12 siblings and not be able to track any of them down or track down any parents is quite unusual. Don't you agree?
Yeah, of course I agree. I mean, if there's that many people, somebody would still be around, or at least somebody would know something.
Mm-hmm. And that actually sort of fortifies my argument that he was a spy. And I've got a lot of other information on in that regard, but it's pointless to talk about it right now.
Well, the only thing is, if he was a spy, he did his so-called dirty work very early on.
Yes.
And he was no technological genius, I can tell you that. Carr, was really, I hate to say anything uncharitable, but he was literally stupid when it came to anything technical. On the other hand, Getz was pretty smart. And, you know, it took me years to piece together all this stuff. And you know, eventually I would like to tell the story in a formal way. But the thing that was one of the most amazing adventures was when I finally was close enough with Carini as a friend. And this was after the research facility in Connecticut was burned down, and Carr went down to, Carini went down to Florida to live, and he had a home down there anyway, and he invited me down. That was a while afterwards. I can't remember exactly how long, but when I went down there, he took me to this incredibly primitive area that he called Pirate's Cove. Uh-huh. And I have no idea where it was. I couldn't take you there if my life depended on it. But the thing that was interesting about it was that in this place, there was a trailer. And I think you have a picture of it, of me and Carini sitting drinking coffee in the kitchen of this trailer, and that picture was taken by Carini's wife.
Yes, posted on their website, yes.
Yeah, and next to the trailer, like within, you know, 50 feet or so, was a semi parked back in the weeds, and in that semi, I later found, was the last model of Carr's Hummingbird project. And it was supposedly, how Carini got it, I don't know. He never really explained it. But I know they were partners on several ventures. And the thing that was interesting about the Hummingbird was that it was supposed to develop enough power to power the average home. You know, and it was a totally electrical device that sat in the basement and just did its thing and turned the generator and supposedly, you know, supplied electrical power to the home. And it was a really bizarre looking thing. And I took some pictures of it and some measurements and stuff. It was pretty big. It was about 4 feet in diameter. And maybe 2.5 feet thick. It stood upright, and it had a bunch of gears and belts and counterweights and other weird things in the middle of it. And at first glance, you would swear there's nothing it could really do except vibrate itself to pieces. And Carini told me that it vibrated terribly when they ran it. I asked him if he ever, you know, got any gain out of it that was worthwhile, and he said, well, they didn't, after they spent all the money to build it, they didn't have any money for instruments, so he said they didn't know. But after having studied that thing and having studied in greater detail even the Carini flywheel, energized flywheel, as he liked to call it, and on top of that, studied the original machine that was built by Tesla to study the relationship between bodies rotating in space, which I guess was stimulated by his investigations into the moon's orbit around the Earth. I came to a very interesting conclusion. I really believe that the machine that Tesla was building was to learn something. He recorded all of this in this blue notebook. I think Carr did swipe the notebook, and I can tell you why, because later on I heard tapes where he said some remarkable things to that effect. But Carini got a chance to study the notebook in Oklahoma City by his own admission, because he went into the office and found Otis Carr sprawled on the desk, drunk as a skunk, and the book was open. And he said that was the first time he ever had a chance to look at it without Carr restricting him to any particular page. He picked the book up and he scanned through it. I don't know how much time he spent there. And that's where whatever he saw that day gave him the idea to build the energized flywheel for his electric car. The other contraption that Carr and Carini collaborated on, which was the home power unit, which they called the Hummingbird, was a totally different looking thing. It didn't bear any resemblance to the Carini device. But the conclusion that I came to after studying all three things, and somehow they may have missed this, was I honestly believe that they were two different parts of the same machine. And neither one of them was smart enough to realize that they were meant to operate together, but they were probably drawn up or explained in the notebook, as separate entities simply because of the complexity of the device. And that's somewhat borne out years later when I found an article written by Tesla himself concerning a design for a new type of craft. And I think I read this article on one of our shows a couple of years ago. And in there, he talks about the fact that the propulsion mechanism was never meant to be an engine of any sort in the normal sense, but rather a device making use of angular momentum and the creation of huge forces, which he felt he could direct and control. And I just think that even if we don't understand exactly what the device was supposed to be, that there are at least two, possibly three major components of whatever it was, and they are meant to go together as opposed to being separate machines.
Yes, and as you often described, Tesla had a habit of sort of leaving some of the details out.
Oh yeah, it wasn't only a habit. I think it was a protective mechanism. He was just tired of being screwed.
So it's
really a fascinating story, and it's very, very complicated in not only in the character of the players, but also in the way in which it played itself out, throughout the last 60 years or so.
Well, yeah, and has been the case in the research that I've been doing, when these people are not, or when it appears that they're not who they claim to be, that's the first can of worms right there that has to be opened. and there's a stench that comes out with that, too, let me tell you.
Well, I think that Carini is definitely a real person with credentials that make sense. I knew all of his family. I knew his two daughters. I knew his son. I knew his wife. I knew the wife's side of the family, and I know that Carini had a brother. Don't remember his name anymore, but I believe he was real. He spent most of his life right there in and around the area of Manchester, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that he could easily be checked out.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. Where I'm noticing a combination of disinformation and basic information that should be verifiable, and it's impossible. This anomaly of having 13 kids in the family, and not being able to find anybody. Parents especially, you know. Certainly one would talk about their family at some point. I think that's just a natural process that occurs with most people, but not with the spies. And I discern actually that Carr, whatever his first name was, but before he took on that alias, was from the same general area of Germany that Scherf was from. That comes out loud and clear also. And I trust that intuition. I'll find the name. It's just I don't have it right now, but I will find it. And with that, probably many more answers to this whole puzzle. Many more pieces to the puzzle.
Well, actually, there are other pieces that I'm aware of. I just don't know how the heck they fit together. And some of them don't make sense, and some of them do. There is a guy that I mentioned to you on one of our shows, and I can't think of his name right now, and he was involved with this Montauk project. He told me a really curious story that he, of course, was very interested in Tesla, and he had taken it upon himself to go and investigate to the best of his ability every hotel where Tesla had ever lived. And there weren't that many of them. You know, there might be a dozen or half a dozen. I don't remember. But, of course, I think the Waldorf Astoria is probably gone by now. Well, one of the big ones that he lived in is gone.
Oh, no,
but he went there.
Waldorf is still there.
Well, one of the other ones that... maybe it was the Astor Hotel. Anyway, one of them that he used to live in was gone. But anyway, this guy went and nosed around in some of the other ones. Now, he made some comments that I couldn't verify myself. And one of the ones he said that in this particular hotel where he went, Tesla had lived in a penthouse. Now, I don't ever remember anybody writing about Tesla having lived in a penthouse. But assuming that it's possible, he did say something which I thought was pretty extraordinary. He said that they approached the manager about the fact that they were investigating this scientist, Nikola Tesla, who supposedly lived in the penthouse upstairs. And he said, that penthouse, he said, hasn't been used since World War II. He said, it's just, we don't use it. And he said, so if you really want to go up there and nose around, he said, I'll let you in. And these guys went up there and nosed around, and supposedly they found a closet that had been sealed over and then wallpapered over, and the only reason why they found it was that the wallpaper was peeling off to the point where they could see the door. That sounds a little odd, but anyway, the story is that they got the door open and they found some artifacts in there. One of them was a radio receiver that had no resistors in it. All it had in it was a series of specially wound coils. Now, I'm not saying that's true or that's false, but the guy who told me this said that he actually took the receiver and tried to get it to work, but he didn't understand the circuitry. And I asked if I could see it, and I was told no. So that, to me, it's you know, there was no reason for him not to show it to me. I wasn't going to run off with it. I just find it, you know, a very difficult thing to swallow. Mm-hmm. But if it is true, it does have certain Tesla overtones to it simply because of the fact that I do know for a fact that he was experimenting with circuits which did not require any resistance to run. As a matter of fact, he was against the idea of resistors in the first place. Even in his magnifying transmitter, he wound his windings for the main parts of the coil in such a way that they could be immersed in liquid nitrogen, and the resistance brought practically to nothing. And to use cryogenic cooling in those days, and part of a machine as large as some of the things he was experimenting with, like out in Colorado Springs, is a pretty amazing innovation. So, and that was pretty early on in his life compared to the time period, you know, that was represented by the radio that they supposedly found. So anything is possible, but I think that there's a lot of important points that are actually still missing, not only in the Tesla saga,
mm-hmm.
and in the Carr / Carini / Goetz saga, but I think there's a lot of technology that vanished that had its origins in the mind of Nikola Tesla. And the thing that I've labored the most to try and find are the details concerning the dynamic theory of gravity. Because if you read the various biographies on Tesla, and you mentioned one earlier, The Prodigal Genius by John O'Neill.
Yes.
He talks about the fact that he wanted to publish this theory because it directly proved that Einsteinian relativity was wrong. And that there was a very concise and reproducible mechanism that could explain the force of gravity, and that he was willing to disclose that. And that statement alone made an awful lot of commotion in that time period, which would have been probably sometime in the 1930s. Then he never followed through on it. And he made no explanation as to why he chose not to publish. So there's all kinds of things that we don't know. And if anybody out there knows anything, it would be real interesting to get the lowdown on additional information.
Now, I did some research on the Astor family at one time, and it was during the course of my Scherf article when I was doing my Tesla research. And I think I recall reading that the two Astor brothers joined their hotels. They had actually two different hotels, which eventually became the Waldorf Astoria. So that might have been, prior to this time. Tesla could have stayed in that part when it was named that hotel. But eventually, you know, the $20,000 bill that he had when he was declaring bankruptcy was issued by the Waldorf Astoria. And then you mentioned this find of this radio or this transmitter in this penthouse, and they found the door behind the wallpaper. Did they think to take the knob off? Did they tell you?
Well, there couldn't have been a knob. There would be no way of hiding the door. I don't know the details. I was more interested in the radio, which I never got to see.
Of course, joking. I'm just testing to see if the listeners are paying attention.
Well, this one is.
That creates quite an image. If the doorknob was still on there.
Yeah. There was something I was going to contribute, and just went out of my head.
Well, we were talking about the hotels for a moment there.
Oh, yes. That's exactly what it was. Thank you. The hotel that supposedly Otis Carr was involved with was the Pennsylvania Hotel.
Yes.
And I personally got in touch with the management over there many years ago and tried to find out if they had an Otis Carr on their employment records. And the story I got was Well, our records don't go back that far, and the hotel was owned by somebody else in those days. And so I couldn't verify anything that way. But the thing that made the biggest impression on me was an interview that Carini made with Otis Carr, and which he recorded. And I regret to say I don't have a copy of the recording, but I did listen to it and I did take notes, and I have copies of the notes. But the thing that was so amazing about that was Carini asked Carr point blank. He said, did you, in the days of your association with Otis Carr, I mean with Tesla, did you ever actually get in and see the inside of his suite, or were you just standing in the doorway chatting with him or whatever? And he said, oh no, I was inside many times. And then he started to describe the entire interior and talked about, you know, how he had all these bookcases filled with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of books on every subject, and on top of the bookcases were models of Tesla's various inventions. And on the walls, he said, there were artistic renditions of places like the Wardenclyffe Tower and his laboratory at Wardenclyffe and the other laboratory in Colorado Springs. And then he had a huge mahogany desk. It was over by the two front windows, and the desk was just strewn with books that had markers in them and manuscripts that were open and this and that. And then he said that off to one side against the wall was a big reference table with hundreds of drawings and calculations and stuff laying all over. And then out of clear blue sky, he said, but I never took anything. And I couldn't believe that he said that. I must have played that back at least five times. Because why would you say that? And the only conclusion I could come to, even though I don't understand the psychology behind it, is that he did take something.
Yeah. We sort of figured that out already, didn't we?
Yeah, but it's just so odd, you know, to hear a person say that.
Yeah.
I, you know what I mean? And so it made a heck of an impression on me. And I just came to the conclusion that I don't know if... I looked at it two different ways, to be honest with you. Tesla was so meticulous and so intelligent, I have a great deal of trouble believing that if he let young Otis Carr into his suite, and all of a sudden a notebook with all of his most cherished information concerning gravity and, you know, this flying machine that he came up with and all this stuff suddenly disappeared, I don't think Tesla would have a hard time figuring out who stole it. So the other thing that occurred to me was that he may have read something in Carr's character that led him to believe that under the right conditions, he might steal something, and maybe he deliberately planted something for him to steal. And then I would say, well, why would he do that? Well, the thing that was interesting is it gets back to the whole story about the dynamic theory of gravity and Tesla's opposition to Einstein's thinking. Maybe there were pressures that were applied to him in such a way that he decided it wouldn't be healthy to publish the dynamic theory of gravity. So instead of publishing it openly, like he promised to do, maybe he thought that for the sake of future generations, he could launch information into the future by arranging for certain things to be put in a book and stolen by somebody with the hope that it would eventually wind up in the hands of somebody who knew what to do with it. Now, it's a far-out theory, but it's no worse than, you know, some of the other speculations that people have made about Tesla's involvement with gravity and why he never published what he knew.
Yes. Now, there's another interesting anomaly or synchronicity, if you want to call it that, between cars, OTC one or X one, I should say, OTC X one, and the Vril craft that the Nazis had during World War II. Looks very similar to that, at least in design, and including the rivets. Now, I can tell you that that craft cannot fly in space. In fact, I had this discussion with our friend General Jeremiah, and he laughed about it. He said the thing wouldn't even fly in the air, let alone go into space. And I concur with him. I had made that remark first. He agreed with me. And not to get off the subject, we have some new pictures of the Federation craft over Michigan, removing chemtrails from the skies. Got a whole series of pictures, and there are some craft that are not part of the Federation involved in this too. There's a hexagonal craft. These pictures were taken by Liz Evenson, Greg Evenson's wife. Greg is a former Kansas State Trooper. He teaches courses in criminology. He hosts his own radio show. And they were aware of this whole event of and story of the Federation. And she heard a plane flying over the house and decided to go out and take a picture of the plane. Well, what she got was chemtrails, and when she looked at the photos, it was replete with craft. Very, very clear representations, and some are in the process of cloaking and or uncloaking, and this is very visible. These are not pigeons. They're not gulls. You know, they're not flies. They're not reflections. Their craft, and they're in different positions as she's taking these photographs too. They're moving around. You can see that they've moved from one place to another. They're identified, and there is a YouTube video that just came out, or it was just directed to me. We'll say I can't remember the date. It may have been out for a while. I'm going to look at that real fast here. August 14th of 2005, there were some craft that made the shape of a cross in the sky. You know, they maneuvered into a formation of a cross, and that was captured on video. And I asked if anyone knew who that might be, and of course I got a chuckle, and he said they caught us again. They're making themselves visible is what I'm saying, and we have many, many reports of this going on around the world. Recently, China. Well, the people ask the question, why don't they help us? They are helping us, and I've alluded to that many times, especially when we have disasters. And they approach the Chinese government about helping some of their people who are starving, and the Chinese welcomed the help, and they asked for the privilege to photograph their craft, and they were allowed to do this. Now, all of a sudden, these images are coming out of China. Well, it's related to that. It's no big mystery, nothing to panic about. Unless you're trying to keep this secret from the people, they panic. They fear us finding out the truth. And that's what tonight's show was about, just revealing what we, you know, piecing the puzzle together, and if the pieces aren't adding up, there's something not right there, Jim. I'm sure you'd agree. And if you could give us some follow-up and closing comments on that, we're going to have to say goodnight here.
Well, there are so many aspects to my relationship with all three of these guys, most especially with Carini and Getz. And so many interesting details, like, for instance, the demonstration of the Vortex engine that that Getz used to perform pretty much routinely. And all of the things that he was teaching, which I came to the conclusion was really just a cover story for his explanation as to why he had this technology. Because he claimed he was a contactee and he had been entrusted with this information, and that the organization he was building up there in the northern part of Michigan was eventually destined to introduce these new technologies, you know, for the benefit of mankind. But I think that was all a cover story. You should ask the general, but I don't think he ever was contacted by anybody. I think this was all his own invention. But the point is that there is a lot of stuff that doesn't add up even from the technological point of view, because the demonstrations that he gave and the equipment that he had to do this with, just, it doesn't add up in two ways. First of all, it's certainly something that operates outside the normal expectations of people who study physics. And secondly, Getz himself, even though he possessed this stuff, he was brighter than Carr by a long shot, but he was not a professionally trained physicist or an electrical engineer. And it's just interesting that he had all this stuff and could do these things. And that's another point that doesn't add up, because it's clear to me that he couldn't have been the inventor. But then neither could Carr or Carini. And so it just keeps pointing back to Tesla.
Mm-hmm. That's the general feeling I get, too. All the technology that was stolen from him and given to the Nazis prior to World War II and during World War II. And then to see, you know, I have on my photos page, I think you may have looked at my website at one time or another and seen the volume of craft that I have there. And I'm going to be updating. Many of these pictures are going to go into a folder where people can see what we've been describing. I've described this phenomenon of the Federation getting rid of chemtrails, and people have remarked that they've seen far fewer of them. Even when they're out there spraying nonstop around the clock, they're able to mitigate these. And that's why. They're mitigating them. They're neutralizing them. And can they keep up with all of them? Well, no. I mean, you're dealing with quite a bit of insanity here. So they can't. They're doing other things. They have other missions, and they do have our best interests at heart. They've talked to governments. The governments are desperate to hold on to this feudalistic system, primitive system, by the way, and they're losing their grasp of it. Things are changing. The reality is changing. They were warned also not to use HARP against people and not to use it against the planet, or it would be destroyed. This is very recently. I'm sure you'll find that very heartening to know that.
Well, I think it's about time that somebody put these people in their place, because, you know, this planet does not belong to us. And that's, you know, the attitude that... The only race that was here that really acknowledged the planet in its proper perspective, I believe, was the Native Americans. They loved it, they respected it, and they were horrified at the notion that the Europeans thought that they owned land. That the Indians said, well, how can you own it? It belongs to God. And these are the same people that everybody calls savages, but I think that they understood the thing, you know, the way it really is. And it's about time that all of that is brought to the surface again, because it's true. We were put here, you know, as caretakers and nothing else. And in my opinion, we've done a terrible job.
Yeah. And we're infringing on the space of other caretakers that aren't going to tolerate it anymore. Pretty simple, isn't it, when you look at it that way? It's not a whole lot of mystery there to realize that every living creature plays a part in the creation. Notice I said creation and not destruction. And they seem to be hell-bent. They, meaning those that play this game, are hell-bent on destroying everything. If they can't have it all for themselves, they prefer to destroy it. And that will not be tolerated. God himself will not tolerate that.
Well, I think we're in those, that.
We're in those times, Jim. Well, I'm sure as time goes on and we have time to devote to digging into the story a little bit more, we'll come up with some more. But, you know, I tried the normal path of research, and it's nothing but a series of dead ends. And so I decided I was going to use my intuition, and I discovered some glaring discrepancies in all of the stories. And I think the biggest one is to find somebody, even from West Virginia, that's got no parents, but they got a family of 13 kids. Figure that one out.
Yeah, I've already dismissed it as, you know, a ridiculous thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're out of time. I appreciate all the information. And, yeah, if you can send me anything, you know, to assist me, I can use the help. I can always use it. So.
All right, my friend. I will dig deeper and see what I can come up with for you.
And in the meantime, keep your eyes open. I'll send you some of these pictures. They're going to be posted on my website here over the weekend anyway. And people will see. The very thing that we've been talking about has now been captured by a skeptic on film. The skeptic's not on the film, but been captured by a skeptic.
I understood it the first time.
Yeah, you know, like to get the grammar right whenever possible. All right, Jim. Well, we got to say goodnight. I want to wish you a good night and a great weekend and look forward to your next appearance next week on Evident Footprints.
All right, Don. Thank you very much.
All right. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. And tonight's guest, scientist inventor Jim Murray. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network at BBS Radio, Seth Hendrick on the sound, Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday night when our guest will be Dr. H. U. Watt. In the meantime, I wish you a great weekend, and I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.